Welcome to Smart Habits for Translators, a podcast for translators by translators, bringing you simple strategies to build better habits. In each episode, we'll focus on specific habits for translators in various stages of their careers. If you're a translator who enjoys learning about habits to improve your business and lifestyle, then this is the podcast for you. We're your hosts, Madalena Sanchez-Zampalo
and Veronica De Michelis. Like you, we are professional freelance translators trying to balance the challenges that come with building a career and maintaining clarity and boundaries between work and personal life. We hope you'll join us in this conversation about smart habits and discover some simple strategies you can apply today to help you build your career and achieve the lifestyle you desire.
Welcome everyone to another joint episode of Smart Habits for Translators and Speaking of Translation. I'm Madalena Sanchez-Zampalo.
And I'm Veronica De Michelis.
Yes, welcome everyone. I'm Corinne McKay.
And I'm Eve Baudet. Thanks for joining us for this episode where our podcasts come together again.
In this episode, we'll be discussing a topic that many of us often struggle with, maintaining healthy boundaries between work and personal life.
Yeah, this can be challenging, especially when you care about your work and love what you do. And so we're looking forward to exchanging some thoughts and ideas on this topic.
So before we start, maybe we'd all like to give a quick update on what's been going on with us in recent weeks or the last month. So for myself, I had 4 weeks off from my master's in conference interpreting classes, which I love, but which are, of course, intense. So it was nice to have that time. And apropos of the topic we're going to be talking about, my husband and I managed to put together a little trip over the week between Christmas and New Year's, socially distanced and COVID safe, including an outdoor New Year's Eve party with Eve and her family when it was, what, 8 degrees?
I think it was 15, but it said 15 feels like,
yeah,
one.
Yeah, exactly. So right up in the mountains, we had a socially distanced outdoor New Year's Eve party even. I went skiing 9 days in a row, nice. And I'll talk more about this in the podcast. But after what a dreadful year it was, I didn't really feel like going, and it was the best thing. So there cool. We go. Madalena, over to you. What have you been up to?
Well, I did not travel over the break, but I did take some time off, which was really nice. I think sometimes those long weekends, you know, we tend to think, oh gosh, what am I going to do? I have some, you know, I have to stay home, but it's just so nice to not have anything that you have to do. So I came back feeling pretty refreshed after that. So I've been working this week on some big translation and copywriting projects for some clients. We've started planning the next ATA conference as well. The call for proposals just opened. And I'm taking the Complete What You Started course with Dorothea Reset through Corinne's Training for Translators, which has been really nice.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, started just this week. And also, I'm working on preparing a course that I'm teaching also through Training for Translators called the T&I Professionals Online Presence Roadmap. So that starts February 8th. Yeah. Hmm. Eve, what about you?
Yeah, so like Corinne mentioned, I'm coming off of, well, not early, you know, the week before Christmas and New Year's, I took a week off, and I think I worked in quotes for about 45 minutes. I had my computer up there, but I was like, just to kind of take a break. And I felt like that was really good. And so, like, I think you said, Corinne, too, this is kind of related to a question that we'll cover later. But my idea was to just let things go from work and just have a really kind of my mind be clear of work stuff for that time. Mm-hmm. So in addition, now I've been revisiting my goals for 2021. I'm kind of taking steps in my own way to outline what those goals are and to make that a successful year for me. Kind of so focusing on some business development activities. And this includes kind of what you mentioned, Madalena. I'm signing up for some classes, some tech classes, and then also focusing on various additional services that I'm going to be offering and marketing efforts to diversify my business in 2021. And cool. Like Corinne said, I did not do 9 days of skiing, but I did 5 of different kinds, downhill and cross country. And cool. I've also been working on my CPA requires that I get him on my books for 2020 in January. He does it every year. Mm-hmm. So I've been working on my taxes. for 2020, and also for the book club. We have the Global Reads Book Club for Translators. We have a new book that we're going to be reading. So,
oh, that's right.
And Veronica, how about you?
Oh, wow, that sounds great. I took some time off over the holidays, but not as much as I had originally planned or hoped. There was some work that I chose to accept over the holidays, but I did still have some days off and just hung out with the kids and my husband. We also added a new fur baby to our family. We got a chinchilla right before the holidays.
Right. Shout out to Larry.
Yes.
Larry. Yeah, Larry the chinchilla. Could it be better?
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. He's just adorable, and the name is hilarious and is a perfect fit for his personality. So my family and I are learning a ton about chinchillas. As it turns out, there's a lot of misinformation and just the lack of knowledge about these animals at pet stores.
Who knew?
Common misconceptions about chinchillas. Yes.
So, are you going to be blogging about that, Veronica?
That could be a new online course.
Fun facts about chinchillas, right? So if there are any other chinchilla owners out there and you want to talk about it, hit me up. Anyway, professionally, I have started this year strong with new energy, fewer goals than I have set up last year, just to be realistic. But there have been some really interesting translation work coming in and other projects. At the time this episode airs, I will have presented a webinar on Introduction to Localization for NOTIS, the Northwest Translators and Interpreters Society.
Oh, cool.
It has been really fun to work on this presentation. I'm getting ready to teach a 6-week localization class to my students at the local college. And this is super exciting because this class has received great feedback from students. Last year, the college asked me to develop a 2-semester certificate program. So I'm working on that.
Good for you.
Thank you. Yeah, super exciting.
Oh, nice.
Yep, that's it for me.
Oh, well, good. Thanks, everybody. That was super interesting to hear all the details about what we're all doing. So I wanted to kick things off now, and we're going to be sharing how we approach managing difficult situations that can arise in our professional life, and specifically as they relate to paid work and interactions with clients. And so I'm going to kick that off by addressing a topic that all of us face at one time or another, clients that pay late. And so I did want to have a little caveat that really over my career, I don't think, unless Corinne can remind me of a case where I'm wrong, I don't think that in all these years I've actually not been paid by someone, but so a lot of these techniques I'll talk about, though, you can apply to people who pay late, and that can help you to avoid, I think, not getting paid in the end. So I think something else that comes up, too, is that every time someone's late, there is that fear, like, well, they haven't paid me. Am I going to get paid? And you want to be paid for the work that you've done in good faith. So I wanted to talk about some things related to that you can do to alleviate anxiety from late paying clients and how to avoid that situation altogether if possible. So I think a really big thing first, and you guys jump in, you know, feel free to jump in, is that first of all, you want to do your due diligence before you accept a job from a client. So that's the first thing that you can do. The first, you know, when it's a new client, you want to do your own due diligence. For example, have you investigated that the client company actually exists?
Yeah.
So as we know, there's a lot of, that sounds silly, but not really in this day and age. As we know, there's a lot of scammers out there, and they're very active in translation and interpreting. As we can all attest from the obviously scam emails that a lot of us receive. Mm-hmm. And there's also ones, too, that aren't so obvious. And for that reason, that technique can be even more concerning because, you know, sometimes we laugh at them like the grammar's bad or whatever. But, you know, sometimes they're tricky, too. So we can all fall for that. We want to be careful that when we're actually accepting a job, we want to get, you know, we want to actually get paid by doing that kind of basic first step. So sites like, we'll put this in the show notes too, sites like the Translation Scammers Directory have a lot of good information about how to avoid getting scammed. So I'm not going to talk too much about that now. But so if you're not familiar with that, it's a good resource, and be sure to check it out. And then in addition, just also use your common sense. If a job sounds too good to be true, then it probably is. And if an email from a potential client, for example, doesn't even mention your language pair or says, which I've had happen many times in scam emails that I get, they're mm-hmm. like, and please remind me of your language pair and I want to pay you $10,000. You know, that kind of thing where you, you know, just there's strange things about the email or it has a weird email address or a spoofed email address, be suspicious. So, yeah, so that's the first thing you can do to avoid not getting paid or to get paid late. And I want to say that you do need sometimes to take, you know, additional steps to do the due diligence, because my husband recently, who's not even in translation, got a email from a recruiter. And I said, it just sounds off to me, so let's check them out. So I went to, there was a website and it looked pretty slick. And then I thought, that's weird that I'm going to Google and link Google these people and look at them on LinkedIn. And the guy who'd sent him the letter on the website, you know, was said like, he's a very well-known leader in this field. And the quote VP and the quote president of the company. But then when I looked at them on LinkedIn, they didn't exist, and they didn't exist anywhere else. Mm-hmm. So even, you know, those scammers took the time to set up a really nice looking website, but it still was fake. So just be careful of that. So once you've established that a company or client is real, of course, there are other things that you can do to make sure that you do get paid and that you're not in the position of getting paid late or not at all. So one thing is, and I know, Corinne, you've written about some of this stuff in your blog in the past, I think, but one thing we can do is charge a deposit up front. Mm-hmm. So I think this is especially important if the amount for the project is going to be a really large sum, or it's going to be paid out over a long period of time. Say it's like a 6-month project or something like that. So legitimate businesses, and I think especially even for, of course, legitimate translation agencies, but I think as legitimate businesses, especially those outside translation, kind of what I'm calling in the real business world, they're used to that and they're perfectly willing to do so. So don't hesitate to ask. Also, specifically for individual clients, I would suggest always getting payment, full payment up front. So what I mean is, like, when I do translate official documents, and I learned that from Corinne years ago, I always ask for payment up front. And so in my opinion, and you guys can weigh in on that too, the risk is really too great that someone will stiff you and you won't have any recourse, especially if it's just like if someone's saying, okay, yes, I agree to $500 for this translation of these official documents. And then if they don't end up paying you, what are you going to do about it? You know, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. I don't know. Corinne, do you want to comment on that at all?
Yeah, sure. Like with those too good to be true assignments, I think one of the easiest ways to filter those is simply even the fact of informing the potential client, you know, I would require payment in advance by credit card or wire transfer. Don't take a check, because that could be a scam too.
Yes.
And I think even asking that will give you an answer as to whether the client is legitimate, because even I had an experience where a job that I was sure was a scam, a book, and I responded that to the potential client, and the next day there was $6,000 in my bank account.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that for the example. Yeah. Wow. So we were like, oh, he's never going to pay in advance. It's not going to happen.
It's a scam.
And the guy was like, okay, thank you, and he wired the money.
Right, so. And I called Eve and said, right, are you sitting down? Because there's $6,000 in my bank account from that self-published author who wants us to translate his book. So I actually think, don't spend a ton of emotional energy stressing out over whether a project is a scam. A legitimate client might come back and say, well, you know, what about if we paid a 25% deposit by wire transfer? I mean, that's a legitimate response, mm-hmm. but I think the mm-hmm. clients you never hear from again, it was a scam.
Yeah, or they're just too nervous. Or I'm mm-hmm. thinking of two of smaller things. That's true with the 6501. That was kind of wow. Yeah, but I think even for, you know, 150 or whatever, for smaller official documents type things, I've never had anyone say no mm-hmm. to doing that, the, you know, and I've also and if they did, I don't care, because then it means they're not going to pay me. So whatever. Yeah. So another strategy to avoid late or no payments is to require payments to pay past due invoices before you start a new project. And you have to decide in that case, is it worth it if it's a good or longstanding client? But even for good or longstanding clients, I've heard different stories over the years where colleagues have continually extended credit to a client and then they ended up getting stiffed for all of it because there were financial problems they weren't aware of or that kind of thing, and the company was going out of business or whatever. So you have to think about, you know, who do you actually want to extend credit to? If someone hasn't paid you, do you want to keep extending credit further and further down the line? Or do you want to not do that and cut your losses or make sure that, you know, they've paid up before you start doing more work for them? Mm-hmm. So, Another thing you can do is change the way that you do your delivery terms. Like, for example, you could say, I used to do 30 days, but because you're behind, I'm going to do now pay on delivery, or I'm going to change from 30-day payment to 15-day payment, because then it gives it more time to work through their system, where you might be thinking, okay, if I, I bill them at 30 days, then it's actually going to take them 65 to pay me or whatever. But if your terms become 15, then you're going to at least shorten that to some degree. So. Mm-hmm. Another tack to take is, if none of these approaches work, you do need to ask yourself if the client that you're working with is really worth the time, the anxiety, and the effort of having to continually follow up with late payments. So maybe the client's just not organized, or maybe they're a credit risk. And if they pay well and you actually enjoy the work, you know, it may be worth the hassle factor to you to, you know, if you think they're a good credit risk, then to put that extra time on the end of being paid. But like I think we've talked about before too, if they're difficult to work with otherwise, or you don't actually feel well paid for the work you do, then you may want to reassess working with them and spend more time, the time that you're spending chasing after them, spend that time marketing to get a new worthwhile client to add to your portfolio. So what are you going to talk about for us, Madalena, about challenges that you face like that?
Yeah, so I'll share mine in a second, but I want to say that you made some really good points there. And I'm like you, I don't think I've ever not been paid, but I have been paid late. I actually wrote a blog post about this too, or maybe a couple, and I can tell you that they're some of the most popular ones on the blog. And I'm kind of like, wow, this is a real struggle for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I agree with all of your points. And I also think that one thing you can do is, when you have a contract, one that shows the client that you are a professional, but also you can, you know, put in some late fees in the terms as well. And I have followed up and gotten late fees tacked on. And sometimes even just telling the client, like, hey, you know, this is now 5 days late according to our contract. You know, I should be sending you another invoice with late fees, but, you know, if this is the first time, I'll just waive it as long as you send it this week or something. And usually that works. Doesn't always work. But then other clients have had to pay the late fees, and they just know that, you know, that's what they signed. So I think you're right about that.
Oh, thank you. I should have mentioned something like that too. So thank you for catching that and for mentioning that, because that's a really good technique as well.
And it does work well. And also, especially if your client becomes unresponsive, which does happen sometimes, because if it's a like large company, they might say like, oh, you know, I sent it off to the AP department. You can always call the company and ask to speak to somebody in the AP department. You know, you're a vendor for them technically, so you can still do that. And I've done that before, and it works really well, because they're like, nope, I never saw this. So they'll follow up internally, and turns out that there was some drop of communication. So that's another way to do it. It's not fun for anyone, but, you know, you got to get paid. So, so I was going to share a difficult situation could be, like, when you are really excited about working with a new client, somebody you'd really love to work with, but then it turns out that they can only offer you a fraction of the fee that you usually charge. So I think this has probably happened to everybody at some point. But on some level, I don't want to say this like super negatively, but I think it's kind of our fault sometimes, because sometimes clients, like, they know what their budget is, and we tend to go into a conversation with a lot of clients, whether they're, you know, an agency or whether it's a direct client, and we say, you know, like, oh yeah, you know, I'm interested in working with you, and you go through all the process, but you never actually find out like what they typically pay for your language pair if it's an agency, or what their budget is if it's a direct client. And I've had this happen, and actually happened to me end of last year, I would say, with a client that I had done some work for. It was an agency, but not a lot of work. And turns out that they, I wasn't getting much more work from them, and they sent like a new change to their contracts. They wanted everybody to sign again or whatever. And I said, well, you know, I don't really feel comfortable signing anything new, and I'm not really getting any work from you. And they said, oh, we'll look into it. And then the manager or whatever came back to me, and she goes, well, yeah, it's probably because of your rates, because we usually pay this for your language pair. And I was like thinking, you're kidding, right? Like, I've been paid my regular rate before, and now you're telling me that you're going to pay a fraction of that rate, something I would have charged like maybe when I started. It was something ridiculous. And so I wouldn't say that they were like a dream client or anything, but it was definitely a letdown, because you think, well, I've already done work at this rate. And I think that happens to a lot of people. And then the other one was maybe it was a direct client who, we had like a discovery call and everything, and this was for copywriting actually. But I really wanted to work with them, a pretty high profile client. Then they come back to me and they say, okay, well, you know, we're ready to get started. We'll pay you this much per hour. And I'm going, it was so low. It was like shocking. And I think it was maybe what they typically pay like a VA or something, which also it was kind of low for a VA. And I was like, so I took some time, and I would say that's one thing that you can do if you really want to work with that client, but you can't accept the low rate. I would say take some time, don't answer right away, because usually those types of responses tend to be a little bit emotional, because you're like, are you kidding? But if you really want to work with them, many times there's a way to negotiate both a higher rate for you, or at least negotiate down the scope of the project. And that doesn't always work with translation, I would say, because, you know, you can't just say, well, I'll take out this many words for that rate. You know, you can't really do that. But you have to be willing to walk away if they're not willing to work with you at the rate that you believe you deserve. And, you know, that is kind of an eye-opening situation when you've been doing this a long time, because you'll see clients that you think would be wonderful to work with and that you figure have a decent budget, and then they come back to you with these low numbers. And so that's kind of where I was getting at before when I said, sometimes I think that it's a little bit our fault because we don't set that expectation early enough. And it's a little bit of a tight line to walk, because you don't want to, you know, start talking about money right away. But in both cases, it came back to me, even though I had set my rate, especially with that agency, but they came back to me with what they were willing to do. And I think that's something we have to do better at as language professionals. We really need to work better on our negotiating skills and our like saying what we believe we deserve, rather than just taking what a client's willing to give. So in many cases, we end up having to say, you know, no thanks, but it's difficult. And I know, Corinne, you've talked about this, and I think maybe Eve too on your podcast, where if you start out accepting a low rate, it's really difficult to raise that later. So don't think that, you know, oh, I'll just do it for this one job and then I'll let them know my regular rate. Like, that doesn't work. You can't do that. So I think that's something to keep in mind, is that it's like Eve said, you could be spending time better by marketing to clients who are able to pay your rates, rather than take on work that will take up your time for a lower rate that ends up not even, you know, paying your bills or something. So,
and I think too, Corinne, I know you've talked about before that just related to the last things you're talking about there, Madalena, that Ed Gandia has a lot of stuff on that too, about not shortchanging yourself and setting the right expectations and that kind of thing with financial, you know, with the rates charged.
And it is hard, you know, especially like if you're new or if you really wanted to work with that client. It's not an easy situation, but, you know, there will be other clients that are great to work with. And yeah. So Corinne, what about you?
So the situation I'm going to address is, what happens when you put your heart and soul into a translation test and then you fail it? So, and I'll tell you a personal story of how this happened to me. But number one, I would say, when that happens, and it will happen to everyone if you go through enough translation tests, the first thing you need to tell yourself is you dodged a bullet, because you avoided working with a client that will not be happy with your work anyway, for whatever reason. And I know that sounds like, oh, just get over it. And I don't mean it, you know, in that flippant way, but I mean, really, really, you want to work with clients who love you and don't know what they would do without you and think that your work is great. And so really, you've avoided a bad situation by having this client tell you, you know, you're not a fit. To me, it's sort of like breaking off an engagement. that honestly, when I hear about people who break off, you know, marriage engagements, that I think, you know, it's sad in the moment, but it's certainly way better than ending up married to someone who you shouldn't have married. That I think with translation tests that you failed, it's sad and hard in the moment, but it's much better than getting into a relationship with a client who doesn't value your work. Yeah. So here's what happened to me. It's no secret that I'm mildly obsessed with Switzerland, right? My husband and my daughter are both Swiss citizens, and, you know, we think perpetually about going there for a year and things like that. So I got what looked like this great inquiry from a potential client in Switzerland that was a luxury, let's say a luxury business in the Geneva area. And I was extremely excited about it. And I did their test and I was quite happy with the test that I returned to them. And they came back to me and said, unfortunately, you failed because for the word, the second in command person in our restaurant, I use the term second in command because they wanted something sort of snappy and American sounding. And they said the person is always referred to as the sous chef.
Oh, geez.
So, which brings me to point two. Then ask yourself, is there any truth to their critiques? And I think the most frustrating situation is when the client doesn't tell you anything. They just say, you know, we're sorry it didn't meet our standards, or we're sorry you failed. And then I think one thing that you might want to do is ask a trusted colleague to look quickly at that sample, because hopefully it's only, you know, a couple hundred words, and to tell you honestly, you know, what they think. You know, to give you a little read on, you know, it shouldn't take them that long to look over a couple of hundred words and tell you honestly what their impression was. But I do think really, really, like when I got over the, you know, sous chef situation, I thought to myself, that is not the type of client that I feel valued working for anyway. Yeah. And by that, I'm not saying like, oh, sour grapes, you know, their loss. I just think it's true that I put a lot of time and emotional energy into relationships with my clients and fulfilling their expectations. And that is not, you know, a client who I feel like I could develop a fulfilling relationship with in any case.
Well, also, I just think that from what you're saying, just my idea, just with that small example, is that not that it's too nitpicky, but that it's too, I don't know what the word is, constrained or something. Like they should be able to look at it in a bigger picture and think, oh, well, in general, we were really happy with it. And then this one terminology thing was wrong, but big deal. We can always, like you're saying, give positive feedback and then we can move forward together. And if that's not the way it's going to work, then you're probably not that interested. Yeah.
But I think that the other sort of grain of truth in there is that I feel like it is extremely difficult, but extremely important to always be open to negative feedback. Yes. So one thing that I tell all of my clients is, you know, my goal is to have an ongoing years-long relationship with you. And in order for us to do that, like in any long-term relationship, we have to be able to be honest with each other. And if you ever have negative feedback about a translation, I want you to know that's an important element of my QA and professional development process to know that. So, you know, basically saying, you know, if there's a translation you're unhappy with, instead of just, you know, trying to forget about it and never working with me again, I need to know that, you know, I need to know what you weren't happy with. And I think that communicating that directly to your clients is to the advantage of your freelance business.
Yeah, that's what I mean too, that you want that feedback. Yep. And so instead of just focusing on like, we didn't like this one word, like you want it to be a positive give and take, whether they're giving you criticism, it's still positive.
Absolutely. Okay, Veronica, over to you.
Thanks, Corinne. It was a great example that you shared, and I can relate. I've had that happen to me too, but the client never responded at all, which was really frustrating.
Even
then,
better.
As you said, right. I wouldn't want to work with someone who doesn't even respond. So so here's a situation that I encountered. One of my longstanding clients, I worked with them for several years, been super happy with each other. They contacted me about a translation job. Which I accepted. I worked on it. I had several questions as I was working on the translation. And so as usual, I contacted the client for clarification. And surprisingly, I never heard back. I followed up, still got no response. I didn't want to miss the deadline. So I submitted that translation with the, you know, translation being to the best of my understanding of those tricky segments, or segments that could be interpreted in different ways. And so I just added comments to those segments in the file that I flagged them, suggesting an alternate translation if I misunderstood the context. And the client said, yes, great, thanks, we'll let the editor know. And then a couple of days later, the client contacted me and said that the editor was really unhappy with some segments, but their comments are in Russian, so the client can't make any sense of them, and could I please check and respond to the editor's comments? And I checked the file and saw that all of my comments were deleted, the ones where I was asking questions and offering alternatives. And the editor's feedback was phrased in an unprofessional way. It was very derogatory and unspecific, like, this part is wrong, or we don't say it like that, and you missed the point. Not really correcting, but really criticizing in a very unspecific way. So I was, it was really upsetting because some of these comments were, well, first of all, when it's in your language, it seems personal. and they were just related to segments that I had questions about and nobody clarified them for me. So when things like these happen, it's really easy to get upset and think, this is unfair. I don't deserve this. I tried, you know. And especially for that reason, I think it's important to take a step back and not make any rash or emotional decisions that would mimic the behavior on the other side. I usually take the high road and I wait a little, I step away for, you know, an hour or a day if I'm able to. And in that case, I replied the next day and I politely let the client know that I would be happy to correct these segments as soon as I received the clarifications to the questions that I sent before and they were never answered. And by the way, I didn't appreciate the tone of the comments and they were unspecific because no alternatives were offered. It was hard for me to implement any changes based on those comments. And I received an email right away with apologies for having missed my previous emails with the questions and a note that there had been similar feedback about this editor before and that they appreciate that. Yeah. I let them know. And it always feels like when these things happen, you know, we feel like, oh, the world is like things are exploding. You know, it's the end of the world. It just feels like a weight is lifted off your shoulders when a situation like that is resolved, in a good way. But I'm always reminded how important it is to take a moment and not act too quickly when something feels like horribly unfair and undeserved. Situation also taught me to be mindful of this when I edit other people's work. And if I am ever tempted to, you know, exclaim, oh, this is wrong, I really try and make very specific suggestions and edits and try to, if there are really good segments in the translation, try to praise the translator as well. Because I think it's really hard when we communicate virtually with colleagues in this translator-editor relationships. It's really hard sometimes to interpret things and it's kind of you don't see the other person, you can misinterpret the feedback, and I just try to not act the way that I have been treated, you know, in the past in that situation and others before. So
yeah, you know, something you said there about them having heard that before about that editor, mm-hmm. I can say that I see a lot of feedback from both translators and editors that we work with, because I have a small agency mm-hmm. as well. And that's actually really annoying when an editor will write back only in comments in the language that, you know, your project manager doesn't yeah. speak or something like that, because it doesn't help anybody. And then you're not sure which person is right until you really sit down and work it out with them. And it makes the whole situation harder. And usually it's not the person who, like you, is asking the questions. It's oftentimes the other person, because, you know, sometimes there are some people who try to feel like they're superior and they want to show, you know, like, I know more than you. And it turns out that person's just really difficult to work with. So that's something to remember, is if your work gets criticized, maybe it is not necessarily that you're wrong. So to think about it that way before you act, I think that's smart.
But I liked what you said too, Veronica, that it helped you kind of, Madeline is saying, but flipping that around in the sense that then it informs us and makes us be more careful. Like mm-hmm. maybe we wouldn't have been that rude, but maybe I would have been, you know, in a hurry and kind of curt or yeah. something. Mm-hmm. Because like you said, I also try when I'm editing to put, if I think something's particularly good, I don't just think, oh, that's, you know, that's what it's supposed to be. Yeah. Then I'll say like, I loved this part mm-hmm. or whatever, or this was excellent expression of the meaning of the source or something yeah. like that. You know, to also not just kind of be making corrections, even though that's our job, so that it comes across more positively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. All right. So let's move to our next topic. Tricky situations and all sorts of misunderstandings often happen in other professional settings too. And all four of us have experience volunteering for our profession. So what are your thoughts on managing difficult situations in volunteer settings? And here's my take on this. I think that serving in a volunteer position, whether it's something you just volunteered for or you were elected for, it's both a privilege because you have your colleagues' trust in whatever you do, but it's also an act of service on your side. And I also noticed that both the people who volunteer and those who don't because they don't have the time or for any other reasons, but they are engaged or passionate members of the association or society that you're all engaged in, we all care very deeply. And sometimes when we care about something very deeply, that passion gets in the way of communication. And people phrase things awkwardly, or maybe they're in a hurry, or maybe they misinterpreted the situation or whatever someone said or wrote. Or maybe they forget about the cultural differences, that we come from different backgrounds. And sometimes they forget that we're all on the same side, and need to work as a team for things to happen. So when I am a part of tricky situations or when I observe them, I remind myself of that, you know, that things can be misinterpreted, and we communicate with our colleagues in volunteer settings, mostly by email or virtually. And it's very easy to misinterpret things when they are in writing and you don't interact with other people face to face. So my strategy is, again, to take a deep breath and assume that this is a misunderstanding and step away from the situation, maybe literally take a walk or do something else, and then come back to it and try to read it from another perspective and think whether I have not communicated something clearly or if I need to ask some questions to understand the other party's side better. So that's my simple technique that I use. What about you, Eve?
Yeah, thanks. My advice having to do with volunteering is specifically addressed to those people who would be volunteers who are interested in volunteering. And as we've talked about before, you know, for yourself, like what do you get out of being a volunteer, for example? So volunteering can be very rewarding, and it should be very rewarding. Mm-hmm. So for example, you get to meet a lot of people in your industry and often outside your industry, because different things I've done where, you know, I get to meet people who are helping me accomplish something for the organization, but I might get to meet someone outside the industry and learn something cool that helps me long term too, or whatever. And different people that you might not have met otherwise, that you probably wouldn't have, just because you're growing your own network. And you also learn a lot in the process about how to execute maybe certain types of tasks, or, you know, I always said, like, when you learn more in depth about your own industry or other industries, or maybe in our industry specifically about translation and interpreting the process or whatever. So you're getting to meet more people, you're getting to learn more things. What I want to say on the flip side is, that's great, that's what you get out of it. Before you commit to volunteering, though, make sure that you're able to actually treat any of your volunteer commitments as like you mentioned, Veronica, professional commitments. So you want to treat them as importantly as your paid commitments. So no one's forcing you to make them because it's volunteer. And so you want to, that when you go ahead and take that step for people to be depending on you, you want to commit to it and follow through. So when, for example, if you aren't able to do that, like you say, okay, well, they're begging me to do it. I guess they really need someone to help. I don't really want to, but I guess they need someone. Then if you're actually not able to follow up, it causes more problems for the organization than it would have been if you just hadn't done it, because now people are depending on you. Maybe they need you to complete a specific task before that they can do what they're supposed to do. And so maybe you kind of then backing out or not fulfilling your commitment affects the efficiency of other people's in the organization as a whole. So so just kind of summarizing mm-hmm. that is, you know, of course it's really great. You get a lot of benefits when you're volunteering, but you're also putting your own reputation on the line with your colleagues. And then people do expect mm-hmm. when you say that you're going to give them a useful result from volunteering, they're expecting you to fulfill your promise. So you want to, another thing that was related to that is that, you know, it's kind of cool that you're meeting all these colleagues through networking, and it's a really great work, as we all know, we've talked about before, one of the great ways to get work is through word of mouth or for referrals from colleagues. But if you do things like you're volunteering mm-hmm. and you're putting your reputation on the line, and then you don't fulfill that, then people will be less likely, for example, to give you an important source, to be a source of referrals, which is an important pipeline. So, yeah. And I actually have a funny story that's related to this, is that one time, a local organization that I worked with, someone volunteered to be the treasurer. And it does seem, looking back on that story, that person was felt a little bit pressured, like, you know, okay, they really need help, I'm going to do it. And then the person just stopped responding to others in the organization, totally wouldn't reply to emails, wouldn't reply to phone calls, and never gave the organization back their checkbook, which at the time, now that wouldn't matter, but that was, you know, a couple years back when checkbooks still really mattered. And we're okay. I mean, you know, that was damaging to the organization, and it was kind of stressful because somebody took off with a checkbook. Nothing ever really happened with those checks, but it could have, you know, it could have been like, were they doing fraud or whatever? So that was an example where that person, you know, felt compelled, they felt pressure to say yes, but then they were really actually not able to fulfill the commitment. So yeah, Corinne, what are your thoughts on volunteering?
So I guess when we talked about this question, I thought about when I served as Colorado Translators Association and American Translators Association president, that I think a number one lesson I learned was people aren't responding to you for who you are. It's what you are or what you represent. That it's not about you personally. It's about the role that you occupy. And I think the best advice I got was David Rumsey, who was ATA president ahead of me, said, you need to do two things to stay sane in this job. So this is for you, Madalena. The first thing is don't get drawn into the drama. The second thing is when you feel yourself getting into the drama, remember the first thing. Yeah. And I think he's Buddhist, so he was a little more zen about it than I was. But I think that there is a lot of truth to that, that the main way to handle drama is to not let yourself be drawn into it. And I think that being in those high profile, you know, volunteer roles, it teaches you a lot about yourself. Like, you know, you guys who are on the ATA board now, now that I'm, you know, retired from association life, can say if you agree with this, but it made me realize, which I think was very helpful to my growth as a person, that it is part of my identity to be the person who gets along with everyone. And I am an extreme people pleaser. And all of a sudden, when I joined the ATA board at all, but particularly when I went from being a director to president-elect, you can't be the person who gets along with everyone anymore. Because I had to reject people's conference proposals, tell them that they missed deadlines, you know, tell another board member that we were not going to implement an idea that they had. And for me, that was a pretty brutal reckoning. So, as an example, at the very end of my ATA presidency, I received an email to the president, ATA president, you know, not to my personal email, to the ATA president email address. And the salutation was, hey, a-hole, but it was spelled out, not like I just abbreviated. And so there were two funny things. Number one, they were looking for the president of the American Trucking Association, not a different ATA, not me. But I think it also says something that I did not immediately assume that it wasn't meant to go to me. That when you are in that public of a role, you get a lot of criticism and you need to be aware of how public of a role you want, because the reality is that it's not your job to be sworn at. And for the record, no actual ATA members ever swore at me. But I think the point being, you get some pretty brutal criticism that can at times be fairly personal, but at the same time, you chose that role. So, for example, we had a senator here in Colorado who was just voted out, Cory Gardner, who was famous in Colorado for refusing to do public town hall meetings. And people would do all this funny stuff, like they had a Cory Gardner cutout figure that they would take to different places in Colorado and be like, you know, Cory's up in the mountains. We never see him in person.
They called it Cardboard Cory.
Yes, Cardboard Cory. And the thing is that various other public officials said, and I think they were right, If you don't want to meet with constituents, get a job in the private sector. It is part of the role to meet with constituents. So, for example, when I was ATA president, so you'll have to do this, Madalena, it is, in fact, part of your job to stand in front of everyone who attends the ATA conference, yep. you know, 1,000 people or more, and let them ask you questions publicly in front of a microphone, and you have to answer right there.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the point being, it is a brutal experience, but it's part of the job, and you know that when you run for it. So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that. So I think it was, you know, learning a lot about myself and also accepting it's not about me, it's about the role, because people don't treat me that way anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And I actually want to say, nothing to do with politics, but with the Cory Gardner thing, because the way Colorado was just half and half, I actually personally think he lost for that reason, that he mm-hmm. could, he might have won politically, you know, for whatever party mm-hmm. you're for or whatever, that were pretty split state. And I, just like you're saying, Corinne, that I felt like, I was like, dude, if you don't want to talk to people, why are you doing it? Mm-hmm. And I actually personally think that is why he lost, not because of which party he belonged to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... Madalena, did you want to give your thoughts on the question or on any of the, now that I've totally terrified you with the
18, oh, no.
which by the way, like I would do it again in a second. I'm not at all saying like, oh, you know, poor me that people, you know, yelled at me, but I just mean it that you have to accept that input from constituents, so to speak, is part of the job.
Well, and I think this is something that as you've been talking, Corinne, and I'll let Madalena talk too, of course, because she's, if she wants to, affected by that, but is the idea that I try to teach my kids just in general, like not even being a public figure. I said, you know, most people, if you're basically normal, nice people will like you, but never will everybody like you. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way life is. And so that's mm-hmm. just part of it too, is that you can't take it personally.
That's right. Yeah.
It's just the role.
Yeah. And that's kind of where I would go to with that. I think that one of the things that I saw early on and not even, you know, in as high of a role as I have now. And I totally know what you're talking about, Corinne. I've already experienced some of that.
Hey, but
not that part. but I do think, you know, in any situation where people are putting in a lot of time and they feel really passionate about which, for lack of a better word, is not my favorite word to use, but you know what I mean. They feel really strongly about volunteering for something because they're very interested in it, or it, you know, it means a lot to them. The stakes tend to be high. So for things that you would think are not that big of a deal, for other people, they are. And so we have to kind of remember that too. If something might not be super important to us necessarily, but it is to maybe somebody else. And so there, you know, emotions can get high in those situations. But, you know, one thing is, I always try to treat people respectfully, and I expect them to treat me that way too. But at some point, you know, you also don't have to take people's disrespect on some level. Like Corinne said, it is your job to answer people's questions, but you don't have to, you know, just take, you know, abuse either. Yeah. And I'm not saying that anybody has abused me, of course, but I think there are some situations where people's emotions are so high that they sort of don't see, that aspect of it, and they really take something a little too far, and that's when you just sort of remove yourself for a bit, even if you do need to deal with a situation. I think there's a quote, and I don't remember now who said it. I'll try to find it for the show notes, but it's essentially like there's power in the time between like receiving a reaction and your response. And that is something that I think is very helpful to remember, is that if you are dealing with a situation where somebody's upset, whether rightfully so or not, you know, you can take a moment. You don't have to, like, you know, give them an answer right away or respond right away. And I also think that it's really important to be one of those people who, when you see something is wrong or somebody is being mistreated, that you say something. Even if, like, I'm not saying call somebody out and, like, tell them off, but, you know, you really should try to, you know, say, hey, like, this is not okay in some professional capacity. And I've seen some colleagues do that really well and really masterfully, and I'm always impressed by that. And I think other people see that too. And it's often the case where I think a lot of people would like to say something, but they don't. They don't want, you know, anybody to turn around on them, you know, and say, hey, well, you know, you and this and that. So I think that it's really important to be the person who, when you see something is not okay and nobody else, you know, is maybe, you know, trying to diffuse the situation, maybe there's a time and a place to do that. And sometimes there's not, but I do respect the colleagues who I think that are able to say, like, hey, let's stop for a little bit and take a step back and look at this a different way. But one thing that I will say, I have always tried to do, and it has served me very well, is I try to surround myself with people who are positive and communicate well and who follow through. And I've done that all the way since I started, which was probably about a decade ago, at least in our large association, a little more freelance-wise and professionally. But yeah, just trying to really, you know, when I know that somebody is trustworthy and accountable and they will get back to you and they will do what they say, I'm more excited to work with that person on other things. And I think that's the case for a lot of people. So
I wanted to add something on it. Just it seemed mm-hmm. to me that there were parallels in what you were saying, Madeline, near the end with what Veronica was saying about giving positive feedback as an editor. Was I was thinking, even if there's not something negative going on, if you like something that someone does, take the time yeah. to tell them. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, not even in people who are in the kind of roles we're in, but like people who write articles, for example, you know, mm-hmm. often like kind of like you guys talked about for translation test, if people are writing an article for a professional, their professional association or the professional magazine for their association, they're putting their heart and soul into it. And they're thinking, I want to share this information. I want to make it well written. I want to do, you know, they put a lot of time into doing that. And so mm-hmm. not even that someone has necessarily said anything bad to them, but if you enjoyed the article, I think it's nice to email the person and say, I really learned this cool thing from your article, or thank you so much for spending your time doing this article, or whatever, mm-hmm. or some other type of volunteering. But if you appreciate it, tell
say
people.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm. So moving on to another roundtable question. I wanted to hear from all of us what we do to remain calm, maintain the calm in our lives, and not let the drama and negativity affect our self-confidence or spill over into our personal life. So I guess I have two things for this. One, I was convinced about a month ago by a friend to try meditating every day. And I mean, it's kind of a little bit of a cliche because I live in Boulder, Colorado, which is like the, you know, woo-woo mecca of the U.S. And I never really meditated before. And let me tell you, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but even meditating for 5 to 10 minutes every morning is really calming my squirrel brain. That I find that idea of, you know, taking a moment to pause, even saying to someone in a difficult situation, like, I like to think about that before I respond because I want to be intentional about what I say to you, is something that I find is coming a lot more naturally to me. I just use YouTube meditation videos, and I do it first thing when I get to work every morning. I just sit on the floor in my office and meditate for 5 or 10 minutes in a very simple way. Which brings me to my second thing. I have really bad boundaries about, you know, work life spillover. So,
really?
Yeah.
I always thought you had the best.
Well, no, but here's what I'm going to tell you. Like, I inherently have very bad boundaries, and so I have to set up pretty intense systems to create space and calm in my life. And I would say the number one thing is that I do not work at home. I haven't worked out of my house for about 8 years. And with a brief pause when my co-working office shut down due to the pandemic, but I then just realized working at home does not work for me because of my leaky boundaries. And I rented a small one-person office where I am right now. It's about a 15-minute walk from my house. So that in and of itself is a boundary that I walk to work and think about other things or listen to another podcast. And I think I set up a lot of systems so that I take care of my mental health, just like I take care of my physical health. So one of those would be, you know, meditation would be an example of that. But I think when I work at home, it is almost impossible for me to ignore, you know, the dishes, the laundry, are we out of cat food? What's that noise out on the street? And not only do I get more done at work, but I think the corresponding benefit is that I go home and I think, oh, here is a place that I do not work. And that has allows me to go home and do things like, you know, play music or, you know, ride my bike on the indoor rollers or do something with my husband and things like that. So I think that why it appears that I have good boundaries is because in reality I have poor boundaries, but I am relentless about creating systems that do that take care of my mental and my physical health.
That's great.
So Eve, over to you on that one.
Yeah. So it's funny that you said you kind of recently got into meditating, because I've been trying to meditate for 2 years. I've been trying for 2 years, for many years. And as everyone can tell, I just think I'm too hyper to meditate. But anyway, but like what you said, lately I've been trying deep breathing and it really does help me. And I think just for what you said, Corinne, that someone's been really encouraging me to do that. And I don't do whatever it is you do to meditate, but I do deep breathing. And I think it is the same effect where I, in essence, am meditating, that I'm making myself slow down, calm down, stop, and do this, you know, really deep breathing for about 5 minutes. And then that kind of frees my mind. So that was interesting to me. I wasn't going to mention that, but then you mentioned the meditating. So I thought I'd mention that too. So then, I guess otherwise, to try to kind of maintain calm, I try when things get not calm, to look at what's happening from just in my mind, try to be rational, think like, okay, you know, and I'm kind of an anxious person anyway. So I think, well, what are the realistic outcome of this thing that's stressing me out? You know, whatever is going on that's negative, most likely doesn't mean the end of the world. However, lately, in all the things we've seen in the last year, in the last week, that might not be true. But normally, you know, I just try to put what's happening into perspective and try to compartmentalize what's stressing me out and try to look at the rational, you know, what rationally would happen even if this was taken to its extreme. It's not going to be that bad. And also what I do is I'm a big note taker. So if something is bothering me and I need to address it in some fashion, and like you guys have mentioned too, like sometimes I want to maybe take a break and then come back to it to deal with it. So it's, you know, I'm more calm or whatever. So what I like to do is make notes about it. And if it needs to be dealt with even later, put it on my calendar. Like maybe I'm going to talk to someone who's, you know, talk to a person in question who we're having a, you know, having a disagreement with or whatever. I make notes about whatever it is. And then that frees up my mind to let that problem or issue kind of be out of my mind until it's time to address it as scheduled. So I get it, you know, I don't feel like I'm not going to forget, or I won't forget what I wanted to say about it or whatever, but I've taken these notes about it and scheduled it to deal with it at a later time. Yeah. So Veronica, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I also struggle sometimes with sort of the leaky boundaries that Corinne has mentioned. And I've been working full time since I was 18, basically. And I've had a lot of time before I had kids and family to really get immersed into the workaholic syndrome and just not being able to, you know, stop thinking about work when I'm at home. So I think I'm much better about it now because I've had such a long work experience, both, you know, professionally in general and as a freelancer for the past few years. So I'm just really aware of how work-related stress affects me. And I really don't want my kids and my family to experience that side of me when I am stressed and when my mind is elsewhere. My kids are both at school during the day, so when they're home, I just remind myself that it's unfair of me to not spend that time with them when they're finally home and it's our family time. My work is something I signed up for, but they didn't, and they don't deserve the stress. So I keep it in my office, and I am really grateful that I have a separate room in our house which serves as my office. So I really, what really helps me is sort of a work shutdown ritual. That helps me imagine how I leave work behind for the day. And sometimes if I was rushed at the end of the day and had to, you know, drop everything and go pick up my kids, and then it was dinner time and all of that, and I didn't have time to do that ritual, I start dinner and I go to my office for 5 minutes just to get this done, because I have trouble decompressing if I didn't do that. So I just turn off my computer, clear my desk, set my planner page ready for the day, and then in my head, it's over and done with for the day. And I feel much calmer. And other things that I find helpful are 5-minute meditations. I really jumped on the meditation train last year. I tried before, but it didn't work, but it started working last year. And I use an app on my phone for that. And just really simple sitting down with my kids and doing like a coloring book activity or a puzzle together just to take my mind off work related things. So that's my strategy. How about you, Madalena?
That's great. I really like those ideas. And I'm like you, I need to wrap up the end of my day or it feels very strange and like something's left undone. But so for me, I also try to keep things in my office as much as possible. You all know I've taken my email off my phone and things like that. It became too much and too many notifications and stressful. I have a lot of apps that I've actually turned off all the notifications for. But one thing that I also do is I take my time to do something for myself first thing in the morning. Mm-hmm. I do not look at my email until I go into my office, and I'm on Pacific time, so I have a lot of colleagues on Eastern time, and so I know that they're 3 hours ahead of me, and so I don't, you know, dilly-dally in the morning. I wouldn't say that, you know, I'm just like, you know, oh, you know, let's take a slow morning. But I really do something for myself in the morning after my daughter's off to school, and it may be something for half an hour, it might be an hour, but you know, that's part of the nice thing about being a freelancer, and we need to take advantage of the fact that we are running our own businesses. And so I think that's something that we often forget, is that we can insert times in our day to maintain calm and, you know, go outside and get a walk or something. That's for me really important, to get outside and to get some fresh air and sun. It helps a lot. It actually helps to clear my mind. I always get new ideas. But it is really important, I think, to prioritize that time. And if you don't give it to yourself, nobody else will. And it's the same thing with your office space, Veronica. Like, that's your space to compartmentalize your work. And I think that, yes, that's easier said than done, because, you know, we keep thinking about our work as we go on, but it's sort of similar to what Eve said too, like, write it down, put it away, and you know that there's a time to get to it. And that is similar to something that I'm doing now. I have blocks of time where I work on specific things. So I don't know, let's say volunteer stuff, since we were talking about that earlier. Specific times of day and specific days of the week to work on certain things. And so if it falls into that and it's not like, you know, nothing's on fire and it can wait, I use, is it called Boomerang on my Gmail? It's a plugin you can get for Gmail. I think a lot of people know about it by now. And I just have it come back to me during that time block when I'm going to be working on that thing. So it's not sitting in my email inbox, you know, staring me in the face, because that's, for me, like, something I find very stressful, is if I see my emails building up and building up and building up. So that's one way I try to maintain some calm, is to get things into certain folders or to come back around to me when it is the time to work on that. And I think that's just a good way to deal with some distractions, because a lot of us do find our inboxes rather distracting. Yeah. Okay, so I think that we're about out of time for this episode, but thanks for joining us for this special episode of Smart Habits for Translators. And speaking of translation, it was so good to talk about managing challenging situations that arise in our professional life and ways to relieve stress.
Yeah, thanks everybody for listening and for joining us. And we hope you'll subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes, we hope that you found all these tips helpful. We'd love to know how you, our listeners, manage such situations. So please share with us on social media, tag us in your post, or leave a comment under the show notes for this episode. And you can find our websites at speakingoftranslation.com and smarthabitsfortranslators.com.
And if you like our podcast, we would love it if you leave us a review wherever you listen. Talk to you soon.
We hope you enjoyed this episode and discovered some simple strategies that you can apply today at work or at home to help you achieve the lifestyle you desire. If you did, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you.
If you have a topic you want us to cover, please send us a message at hello@smarthabitsfortranslators.com. If you like this episode, we'd appreciate if you'd leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts.
and please share the podcast with other translators you know.